You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening, and we have much to cover this hour, from dwindling fuel supplies in parts of the United States to an overabundance of hot air on the podium during the constitutionally mandated State of the Union address. All right, maybe there is more than just hot air in them there speeches. We'll explore some of the deeper linguistics of presidential keywords. Also, two people on a journey to make sure both get to do what they love, the patience and sacrifices families make to allow one member to pursue a dream. And e-cigarettes, the vaping culture of electronic cigarettes. It's way beyond the drugstore.
Now when I go to public places that don't allow smoking, I can whip out my Blue and know that I won't scare any guys away. Blue e-cigs have been an absolute savior for me.
The pros and cons explored this hour. But first, to the escalating political crisis in Ukraine, a crisis developing in the shadow of Moscow, with Russia increasingly nervous as the Winter Games in Sochi are less than 2 weeks away. Ukraine's justice minister today threatened a state of emergency as protesters have targeted the ministry building with barricades. A group of protesters are now actually occupying the justice ministry, calling once again for the resignation of the country's president, Yanukovych. Opposition protesters have also made gains far outside of the capital, Kiev, into territory up until now not part of the political turmoil. Zenon Zawada is a journalist voice from Ukraine who reports for the Ukrainian-American population here in the U.S., as well as analyzing Ukraine's financial situation for the banking industry. He joins us now from Kiev. Zenon Zawada, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello from Kiev.
So let's talk a little bit about the developments over the weekend. The Justice Ministry seems to be targeted. Why?
Well, it's another case of the radical end of the protest taking things into their own hands and at their own pace. The more contemplative end, which is where the politicians are, they prefer to take things at a slower pace. Then there's the radical types who see the need to take over government buildings as not only they took over the Justice Ministry, but also the Energy Ministry and Agricultural Ministry.
Is there any sense from your perspective that this is getting out ahead of the forces within the opposition that can control the radicals?
Well, the funny thing about this protest, as compared with 2004, which we all remember was the Orange Revolution, this time around, it's a grassroots protest. Now, a lot of the Russian propaganda would have you believe otherwise, that this is some CIA operation or whatnot. But actually, what's going on now is more people-based, and it's driven by civic organizations. And we have a situation where the politicians are actually struggling to keep up with the pace of protests and the events, unlike 2004, which was strictly a political protest. It was a presidential election, the vote was falsified, and people came out to protest the election fraud.
If you could climb into the mind of President Yanukovych, I know it's difficult to do so, but from his perspective, when he looks out and sees this protest versus what happened a decade ago, what does he see that's very, very different from then?
Unfortunately, I think he doesn't see much difference, and my sources tell me that he sees events in the very same way that they were 10 or 20 years ago. It's this very rigid post-Soviet mentality that's fomented by the Putin regime in Russia throughout the former Soviet republics, and it's this us-against-them mentality, this zero-sum game, where the West, led by the evil Americans, are trying to spread their influence, particularly economically, into regions closer and closer to Russia. And there have already been surfacing different placards, anti-Maidan protest placards, which depict the U.S. encroaching first on Libya, then Syria, then they're getting closer and closer to Ukraine. I think his mentality is post-Soviet, always has been, not only for him, but for his generation as well. We're talking about people 60 years old and over.
Tell me about the gains that the opposition seems to have made in parts of Ukraine that are believed to be sympathetic, really, to Yanukovych.
Yes, that's a very interesting aspect to this. What happened this weekend was that not only have citizens in the western and central regions, which are sympathetic to the opposition, not only have they taken over the presidential arm in their oblasts, their regions, but there have been uprisings in the regions that are typically supportive of the president, such as Dnipropetrovsk and Zaporizhia. Another important thing to consider is that the president reportedly called a meeting on Saturday, inviting his party members, and a significant portion of his parliamentary faction did not show, about a third of his parliamentary faction decided not to show. It shows signs that his grip on power is slowly eroding at the moment, not only within the regions that he's typically popular in, but also among his party members.
Zenon Zawada, your sympathies lie with the opposition on some level. Is that fair to say?
I'm a Ukrainian-American. I certainly favor rule of law, private property rights, and equality before the law in Ukraine.
Is there something about this protest that caused you to really sort of cross over a little bit in terms of your sympathies?
Quite the opposite. Living in Ukraine for almost a decade, I've come to appreciate Western civilization and American values, particularly rule of law. We often take for granted the institutions that we have in the U.S., where you can get a fair court trial and when you could defend your property against some kind of a business raid.
Zenon Zawada in Kiev, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rule of law is not likely to be an issue that Barack Obama raises in his State of the Union speech tomorrow night, at least not regarding the U.S. He may criticize the Congress, call for some new programs, but rule of law seems to be settled here, if not in Ukraine. We would love to know what you think the president should devote his speech to tomorrow. Later in the hour, an artist deconstructs State of the Union speeches in terms of a president's favorite words. What do you think should be at the top of Obama's priorities? A favorite word for this president? Pick some. The economy? Minimum wage? Bronx, New York. Education. Why do we spend more on incarcerating people than on educating them? Tax-based funding has failed our most desperate kids. Figure out alternatives. Or Portland, Oregon. I love his fight for a real living wage. Often I think he's had to compromise too far away from his original goal, so I really hope he sticks to his guns on this one. Or Colin Cole from Seattle. I think we need federal reforms to our electoral system and laws to prevent or restrict gerrymandering. How can we expect to get anything done if our congressional representatives don't actually represent the population? And right here in New York, apologize for the fiasco known as Obamacare. Wherever you stand on the political spectrum, your thoughts are welcome at facebook.com/thetakeaway or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll let Kent right here get the last word.
Hey, this is Kent in New York. I think that important priority would be for President Obama to consider prison reform and federal protection from discrimination for people based on gender and gender expression, especially for trans people and people who are gender nonconforming.
Let's take you somewhere now that feels familiar and unfamiliar. A trip back in time, perhaps? A slightly seedy lounge. A downtown address. Will it be, pal? Step up to the bar.
This is one of our newer flavors. This is Mother's Milk by Suicide Bunny. It's a milky, creamy custard with a strawberry.
That's not a cocktail. It's more a concoction. And you don't drink it.
Ahmad is a derivative of what they used to do when e-cigarettes were just little e-cigalikes that looked like cigarettes. And they wanted more power out of them, more battery life.
With all the opaque jargon of an Apple Genius Bar.
A clear out is basically a clearomizer or the tank section of the Ego battery or mod. And it has a coil in it that heats up and wicks up all the juice and then vaporizes the liquid nicotine and flavoring.
And the relaxed escapist diviness of the movie Casablanca?
Hemingway would be here now, I think. Because it's totally experimental and fun, and people, there's really no laws here. You can't smoke cigarettes.
You have arrived at the e-cigarette Henley Vaporiums. This cheerful little spot is New York City's first e-cigarette bar, where smoking is vaping, and the mechanism for inhaling is a complicated-looking electronic device with battery, USB port, and mouthpiece. Miniature soprano saxophone meets digital thumb drive. It's legal, and no smoke gets in your eyes. That's kind of the point, says Henley Vaporium co-founder Talia Eisenberg.
This is a decal, a wall of 80 of the 5 or 6,000 chemicals, they say, that are in cigarettes. You know, the names are from nitrosity and propylamine to butanone to carbamic acid. I mean, it's scary for people to walk in as a smoker and see this, and they realize all the gunk that's in cigarettes, which is not in electronic cigarettes. There's only 5 ingredients, and those are propylene glycol, which is found in asthma inhalers, vegetable glycerin, which is an organic matter, water, nicotine, and then flavoring.
This place has also none of the no smoking here public stigma that comes with all the smoking bans from public places. Henley co-founder and co-owner Peter Denholt says the message to smokers is come in from the cold.
And to have a place that's not a bar, not a club, not a place where people are to have to go to meet other people, there's now a place where they can come, they can vape, they can enjoy a cup of coffee, they can turn on their Wi-Fi, and it's a different experience to bring people together, and it's a healthier experience.
Denholt smoked for 35 years before switching to e-cigarettes. He's an evangelist now for this growing vaping culture, a nicotine addiction he says he can live with.
I happen to love nicotine. My body knows nicotine more than it doesn't know nicotine since I've been smoked for so long. So nicotine works for me, and I'm happy to have a better way to put nicotine into my body. Would I rather have a life without nicotine? I don't know, but who wants to be addicted to anything? You want to be free of all things and have choice at all times, and being addicted to something doesn't allow you to do that.
And this is the puzzling part. Eisenberg and Denholt stop short of being enablers for people who have never smoked. It's health, they say, they are pushing, not nicotine.
We would definitely discourage you from trying anything with nicotine. We would encourage you to try something that does not contain nicotine if you choose to do so. I don't think there's anything healthy about putting anything in your body that's not meant to be there, but if you want to try it, non-nicotine would be the way we want you to go.
Peter Denholtz, co-founder of the Henley Vaporium in New York City. This is a lifestyle thing. It's also a hobbyist subculture. People are into their own flavors and voltages, and they talk about it. There's an actual drill press behind the bar for people to mechanically modify and customize their own inhalers. Where is this growing e-cigarette movement headed? It's clearly here to stay. Henley Vaporium is just the beginning of something, but what?
Come to where the flavor is. Come to Marlboro Country.
You may have seen this. One of the Marlboro men of advertising legend died over the weekend. Cowboy Eric Lawson was 72. He died of a smoking-related respiratory ailment, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. There was not an e-cigarette option for Lawson back in the 1970s, and the question is, would anyone have really wanted one back then? The tobacco industry sold mystique and literally coolness.
So refreshing, so cool.
As cool and as clean, cool. As a breath of fresh air. Cool. That's Snow Fresh Filter Cool.
Do you think that the marketing of e-cigarettes is headed down the same path as smoking ads? David wrote this on Facebook. I've tried them before. I'm a non-smoker. I've also been around them in public. They do not smell. The vapor disappears immediately. And other than the sight, you would never know someone was using them. One could argue that they glorify smoking and kids may not understand the difference, but that is no excuse for a ban on something that could help someone stop smoking. Well, Michael Erickson, founding dean of the School of Public Health at Georgia State University and former director of the CDC's Office on Smoking and Health, is trying to answer the health questions surrounding e-cigarettes scientifically. Georgia State just received a $19 million grant from the FDA to study why people choose to try e-cigarettes and what using them does to the body.
Well, it is very disruptive and no one quite knows what to expect. Technically, while e-cigarettes look like medical devices, they're considered to be tobacco products by a court of law. Even though they contain no tobacco, but they do contain nicotine, which is derived from tobacco. Why this is important is that if it was determined to be a drug delivery device, it would be regulated under a different section of the FDA law than if it was a tobacco product.
Now, e-cigarettes are marketed as cigarettes you can use without the restrictions of smoking bans and secondhand smoke and that sort of thing. It also seems to suggest that nicotine without all the tar and smoke is benign. Do we know that any of that is true?
Well, the first thing that we know is that the reason smoking kills people is primarily because of the smoke. Having said that, nicotine is not benign. but it's much, much better than smoke. So you have a bit of a conundrum. E-cigarettes are almost without exception safer to use for a smoker than traditional smoking, but that doesn't mean they're safe. And that's what the concern is that people will use e-cigarettes on an increased basis, more exposure to nicotine among kids and possibly among ex-smokers. And what we're seeing is a lot of people doing both, continuing to smoke when they can and then using e-cigarettes when they can't.
Would you say that e-cigarettes are only appropriate for someone who has smoked or is trying to quit and are inappropriate for someone who is basically looking to experience a nicotine addiction?
Absolutely. The ideal situation is for current smokers, first of all, to quit unassisted, just to quit. If they can't quit on their own, is to use some type of a product, if necessary, to help them to quit smoking, and then ultimately to quit the e-cigarette or the nicotine product as well. We certainly don't want people who are not using nicotine, like teens or never smokers, to start to use nicotine because it is a stimulant and in larger doses is toxic.
But we tolerate coffee, we tolerate alcohol, we tolerate a lot of addictions.
The thing that's, I think, different about nicotine is that nicotine is extraordinarily addicting, and it's still of concern.
If e-cigarettes can acquire some of the coolness and social permission that smoking once had back in the days of Bogey and Lauren Bacall, does the idea that they're a nicotine replacement product get lost in a cool new experience that gets you high? And you could replace the nicotine with any other molecule that gets you high, right?
Yes, there are major social implications of people administering drugs to themselves over the course of a day. You know, we have tolerated it with traditional smoking and at some level alcohol and caffeine, as you've mentioned. But with these e-cigarettes, they're literally drug delivery devices that some people carry around their neck in lanyards and will reach down and take a hit whenever they like, and it has a pharmacologic effect on the brain. The marketing of it is a particular concern because not only is it glamorizing and in some ways sexualizing e-cigarettes, it's concerned that it's going to renormalize smoking. In other words, a lot of the progress we've made around the world is to denormalize smoking, that from it becoming a popular thing to do and attractive, it's to become in some ways a deviant behavior. The way e-cigarettes are being marketed, it really may have that effect of making not only e-cigarette use but smoking in general more desirable. E-cigarettes are being advertised on television for the first time any type of tobacco product has been in 40 years. And your listeners just have to go and Google Jenny McCarthy and Blue, or Playboy has their own e-cigarette and they have an ad out, and you'll just be stunned at what you see.
What are you going to study in your FDA grant, and how far behind is the government in really getting an alternative message out to what you're already seeing?
Well, in our grant, we're really going to be investigating decision-making of how do people make the decision to use a traditional cigarette or an e-cigarette, and also what kind of motivation people need to really stop smoking completely and make tobacco fundamentally a phenomenon of the 20th century.
Well, e-cigarettes have certainly planted their flag in the 21st century, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's been extraordinary. The data are showing rapid and incredible market penetration, both among adults and among teenagers. The latest data from the CDC has shown the usage of e-cigarettes among high school students to have doubled between 2011 and 2012, where now about 10% of high school students report having tried e-cigarettes. And this is at a time when traditional smoking of cigarettes is at the lowest levels in a generation. So what we're seeing among youth is less cigarette smoking and more use of e-cigarettes and also little cigars and cigarillos, which aren't regulated by the FDA, and they still can have flavors, as can e-cigarettes. We estimate that about 8% of all adults have tried e-cigarettes, and almost a third of smokers have tried it. So there's been really remarkable uptake of e-cigarettes over the last few years.
Michael Erickson is a founding dean of the School of Public Health at Georgia State University and former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Office on Smoking and Health. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You may not know this, but there is a state of emergency in the state of Alabama right now over a shortage of propane gas. Alabama joins Texas and Ohio, those states also with states of emergency over dwindling energy supplies. Jeff Helms is communications director at the Alabama Farmers Federation. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So how important is propane to the Alabama farm economy?
Well, poultry is the number one agricultural enterprise in the state of Alabama. And propane gas is extremely important to keeping poultry houses heated and making sure that we can continue to have a thriving poultry industry in the state.
Now, propane supplies are stored in those big white tanks that you see on farms across the country, and it's those tanks that are running low.
Our understanding is that it's more of a logistical problem, at least in Alabama. It's a challenge of getting the propane from the distribution points on the pipeline to the individual dealers and then from those dealers back out to individual farmers across the countryside.
Over the past few decades, have farmers found themselves in competition with a proliferation of new users of propane? It seems to me that traditionally farmers have had this market mostly to themselves.
In rural parts of the country, that's not necessarily true. You know, propane, the two options are really propane and natural gas. And natural gas lines tend to be run in areas where there's a high population density and where the terrain really lends itself to being able to bury those lines. If you grew up in rural Alabama like I did, you depended on propane also for residential use. So it's not so much that there's an increased competition, at least domestically, I think, for propane.
And propane, you know, even though it may smell like natural gas, is actually a refined product of the petroleum industry and depends upon oil supplies and what refineries decide to produce from the crude that they take in. Is that correct?
My understanding is that there are a couple different ways to produce propane, and one of those is a byproduct of the crude oil, I guess, distillation process, and it is put into pipelines, at least here in Alabama, pick that supply up. That gas is then shipped to individual dealers, and then they are the suppliers to the farmers or to the residential customers or to other business.
If this persists, are prices of poultry, of chicken, going to go up? Are farmers going to have to start slaughtering? What happens here?
The farmers who are in the most immediate need that don't have a ready supply of propane and who have small chickens. The chickens have to be kept at about 90 degrees the first day that they arrive at the farm, and you step the temperature down about a half a degree a day over the next week or two. We've been working with the propane gas industry and the trucking association, elected officials and others, and we feel like we've addressed those farmers with the most immediate need. We had a large dealer of propane here in the state that was not able to continue delivering propane to some of their farm customers, and that has created a problem for some of those growers. What you'll see in Alabama, at least, is that you may have farmers that would normally receive chickens that they're not going to because they don't have propane to heat those houses. And so if you raise about five flocks of chickens a year, that could be as much as a 20% loss in your income. Then you have farmers who have a dependable supply through a dealer that they have a relationship with or a forward contract. But if they don't have contracting, then you've seen the price go up 80% to even double recently. And so they're just going to be spending a lot more money, and that cuts into their bottom line. So it's really a number of factors depending on where you are as a grower.
Talking about the state of emergency in propane supplies in the state of Alabama, that's Jeff Helms, communications director at the Alabama Farmers Federation. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
So what is causing this propane shortage, and how likely are these apparent supply bottlenecks and price spikes to persist? Is this all seasonal, structural? Who saw this coming? Is it a consequence of polar vortexes and other crazy weather this winter? Roy Willis represents the propane retail industry as CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Roy Willis, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you.
So what is causing the shortage? Is it a seasonal weather factor or more complicated than that?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but certainly weather has been the major player. Record cold, especially across the Northeast and the Midwest, have significantly increased demand. We had a record demand for propane for drying the crops, almost a five-fold increase in demand for propane during the corn harvest season. In addition to that, we're at a point now where we're actually exporting propane at record levels out of the country at the time that inventories in major parts of the country are at their lowest level than over the last 5 or 6 years. So it's a confluence of weather and just the way that the natural gas shale development, which has actually increased significantly our supply of propane, something like three times more propane comes from natural gas than from crude oil refining. But almost all of the increase in supply has been basically shipped down to the Gulf Coast and then onto tankers and shipped out of the country.
And we are one of the largest producers of natural gas in the world, if I'm not mistaken. And those contracts for export of propane are already in force and need to be honored. You can't actually divert that exported propane, right?
I'm not certain about the nature of all the exports. There are truly some contracts out there that are what they call take or pay. You either take the propane or you have to pay for it anyway. So those kind of contracts are certainly going to be shipped out regardless of conditions. But up until just this winter, the price of propane in the United States was much lower than the world price. And as a consequence, the demand worldwide for U.S. supplies grew very rapidly. Because it was less expensive. The opposite is true now, although we are becoming once again an importer nation because we're importing certainly in the northeastern part of the United States where they have facilities capable of receiving tankers bringing supplies in from overseas.
Is there an efficiency question here? As important as it is to dry corn when it's harvested, is it really terribly energy efficient to dry it with large propane heaters?
Well, indeed it is. In fact, the heaters are getting more efficient, and we've been working with a number of the manufacturers. Part of the portfolio at the Propane Council is research. And we work with manufacturers, and we've been developing grain dryers, for instance, that use 35% less energy to do the same amount of crop drying as the older technology. Efficiency in the propane consumption has actually been growing very rapidly and on a pace of about 1% to 1.5% a year nationwide. So we're actually getting more done with our propane supplies than ever before. But the fact of the matter is that we haven't experienced this level of demand for space heating like we have just this winter. This winter is unprecedented as far as propane demand is concerned.
And could you comment on the poultry industry? A lot of vegetarian public radio listeners out there will say, well, if you have to keep a chicken house at 90 degrees and that's the only way to keep them alive, maybe there's something wrong with the supply chain.
Well, I can't go there, but I can tell you that the agricultural segment uses about 20% of the propane consumption in the U.S., and they use it not only for crop drying, but for the vegetarians out there, also greenhouses that produce vegetables year-round depend on propane for space heating.
All right, so a lot of demand there for propane, helping to explain why we're having these price spikes and bottlenecks. Roy Willis is CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Roy, thanks so much.
Delighted to be with you.
The State of the Union.
The State of our Union.
State of the Union.
My fellow Americans.
The state of our union is
going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
That's right. We've got that yearly ritual coming up tomorrow. The State of the Union Address. President reporting to the nation on the priorities for this year.
What comes of this moment will be determined not by whether we can sit together tonight, but whether we can work together tomorrow.
From Barack Obama's 2011 speech. This year, it will be the gridlocked Congress in the audience clapping or scowling on cue. Hopefully no open brawls with Supreme Court justices. But what if we could just boil the whole belabored thing down? The George W. Bush State of the Union study guide, Cliff Notes, might go something like this.
Terrorists disrupt terrorist plans.
Bring terrorists to justice.
We will shut down terrorist camps.
Embolden the terrorists.
We must prevent the terrorists.
Because Iraqis are
not too surprising to note the favorite words from the eight Bush years. Reagan condenses down to something like this.
The deficits we face.
Taxes would not mean lower deficits.
Largest series of deficits.
Biggest deficits.
Budget deficit.
Deficit steadily.
The deficit problem.
Artist and composer Luc Dubois inspired us to make these audio versions of a project he calls Hindsight is Always 2020. By data mining and statistically assigning a value to words depending on how many times they're used, he's created these eye charts that make the favorite presidential words the largest on his panels. They jump out. He examined State of the Union addresses from George Washington through George W. Bush. You can check out Luke's work at thetakeaway.org, and while you do, tell us what you think should be the priority for the president in his last 3 years. You can also call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's foresight we're looking for from you out there. But Hindsight from Luc Dubois joining us in our studio today. Welcome.
How you doing?
So this is a great project. What inspired you?
I was inspired by kind of staying up a lot at night and watching, this is back in 2006, 2007, 2008, watching a lot of late night talk news and people really starting to deconstruct language and starting to use statistical processes to deconstruct language and political rhetoric. So I was like, well, originally I was going to do something kind of dopey, like I was going to make a, you know, kind of Billboard Hot 100 list of things presidents say.
Right.
So, you know, God bless America. I am not a crook, whatever. and I was up, you know, sort of late night watching back when Crossfire was on CNN,
right,
the first
right.
round, and James Carville was on a rant about George W. Bush, and he kept using the word vision. He kept saying the man doesn't have vision, 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 vision. And so I'm sort of sitting up late and I'm thinking, yeah, that's the word you use. You use the word vision to talk about leaders, you know, and to say how good they were. And so the way you test vision is you make eye charts, right?
Ah.
So I made eye charts, and there's one for every president of the United States, and it was commissioned for the 2008 Democratic National Convention in Denver. So it's a five-year-old piece. There's no eye chart yet for Barack Obama because he's not done.
Right, and so you're working on that now. But let's look
that.
Back in history, because these are snapshots of personality and mm-hmm. also snapshots of history. Let's try for Woodrow Wilson or FDR or LBJ. Give me a tour of those.
Yeah, so some of my favorite ones. LBJ is actually my favorite one because his number one word is tonight. That's because he was the first president to do everything on primetime television.
Oh,
so he began every paragraph with the word tonight. His number two word is Vietnam.
Of course.
FDR gets kind of the best words because he gave 15 of these speeches, but his number one word is democratic. Going back, you know, Herbert Hoover's number one word would be unemployment.
Of course.
Calvin Coolidge is interesting. His top three are veterans, flood, and prohibition. Right?
Flood. What's flood?
It's the last time New Orleans flooded.
Oh, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, Clinton is the most interesting to me in terms of I would never have guessed this.
Yeah, Clinton spent a lot of his time talking about the century in which he would no longer be president, right? So the 21st, but maybe his wife will be, right?
Interesting.
Yeah.
What about Carter?
Carter's is us, which I like a lot. It's not. It looks like it reads U.S., but it's us. His rhetoric is pluralized. He says we and us instead of I and me. Kind of almost like a, you know, it's almost like a pastoral rhetoric, like he's giving a sermon. So that word popped out. The way I designed the piece is all the words are unique. So it's the 66 words that each president uses in their State of the Union more than any other president. So George Washington's number one word is gentleman. George Bush's terror. That means those are the words that they use the most, but it's also they use them more than anyone else.
Well, since eye charts don't necessarily work on radio, we took a couple of examples and brought them. You heard them there. In light of the shortage of propane we've been talking about today, here's President Gerald Ford.
crude oil fee level.
Price of petroleum.
Oil exporting.
Of crude oil.
Barrels per day.
Per barrel.
2 million barrels.
Crude oil.
$2 per barrel on March 1st.
$1 per barrel.
Oil exporting nation.
Reliable and adequate energy.
Consumption of energy.
Energy stability.
And increasing our production.
And you need to remember that you only have a few examples of State of the Unions for Gerald Ford.
Yeah. He only gave a couple. So the words that come to the top are barrels, crude, and gas.
Interesting.
Which makes sense, yeah.
And, of course, everyone's favorite in terms of ironies of history, Richard Nixon.
Mm-hmm. Truly opened the door.
Truly brings heart.
Truly is of the people.
Truly revered leader.
Truly renewal.
And the environment.
Our natural environment.
Preserve our environment.
To protect the environment.
Truly significant advances.
To improve the environment.
We can have government that truly is by the people.
Truly for the people.
To the truly disadvantaged of a truly free society.
This was truly a great Congress.
Truly. I mean, there's nothing to say there.
You can't make that up. It's just too excellent.
He created the Environmental Protection Agency.
Absolutely.
So he really is an environmental president there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So when you get around to Barack Obama, what do you think?
I don't know. I sort of did a temporary one a couple years ago looking at just his first few speeches, and his number one word that came to the top was new.
Huh.
It was new, and then people, then American, then years, then work, then every, then tax, country, just, and world.
Change doesn't even make the top 10.
Change comes in around line 5. The funniest one that everybody says it's going to be is hope. Number of presidents sort of claim statistically that that's the word that they use the most. But the truth of the matter is hope is both a noun and a verb. So everybody uses hope all the time. In the construction, I hope that Congress will vote on this. I wasn't really thinking. I didn't do any work on analyzing part of speech. The words are just words.
Yeah. Hope.
Yeah.
Hope, the of politicians.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Luc Dubois, artist and composer, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Luc Dubois composed the piece Hindsight is Always 2020, which you can check out at thetakeaway.org. And you can also hear all 4 of our montages of State of the Union addresses and the favorite words of presidents.
Disrupt terrorist plans.
Bring terrorists to justice.
We will shut down terrorist camps.
Truly brings heart.
Truly is of the people.
Truly revered leader.
Truly renewal.
And the environment.
Fee level.
Price of petroleum.
Oil exporting.
Of crude oil.
Barrels per day. Per barrel.
Taxes would not mean lower deficits.
Largest series of deficits.
Biggest deficits.
Budget deficit.
Deficit steadily.
The deficit problem.
So how's it going out there? Are you loving what you're doing?
Hi, my name is Lori. I'm calling from Miami, Florida. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm blessed to love what I do.
Our conversation last week about the dubious pursuit of what it is you love inspired a lot of you to wave at us from a very good place.
Hi, my name is Nicola. I'm from East Brunswick, New Jersey. I recently dropped out of college. I was going for a psychology degree, and I really did not see myself in that field. And I, much to the chagrin of my parents, went into the massage therapy school. And I absolutely love what I do. I help people. I'm good at it.
I can see my dreams. I know I'm going to be better.
Hi, my name is Susan. I'm from Rhode Island, and I'm very fortunate to be able to paint as, I was trained to do and I love doing, but I also had to become a nurse in my 40s to make ends meet. But I do both, and I'm just lucky to be able to paint.
Congrats to all of those of you out there having the time of your lives, making it happen. Well, 2 of you out there join us now who are making a team effort as a couple who have the time of their lives doing what it is that they love. Jay Bourne and wife Betsy Thorleifson, welcome.
Thanks, John.
Thank you
for having us.
We should note that Jay has actually been upgraded from listener to actually one of our interns.
Correct.
Over the last few months. Let's just talk basically about you as a couple. It seems to me, as a baker, you founded a company called 9 Cakes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You seem to be doing what it is you love right now. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
How did you take the plunge? What was it like?
I just decided that I was tired of working for other people and needed to do something that I wanted to do, and so just jumped in and did it.
And have you always made cakes? Were you working in some sort of baking sweatshop up until you started
Nine
Cakes?
No, actually not. I had always loved to bake, and so it was a hobby and something I did just for fun, and had always found myself working with kids or teaching.
Well, cake is a very basic term for the kind of cakes that you make. I mean, if people can go and actually see the cakes that you make, they are elaborate works of art. When Betsy decided to do this, how much encouragement did she need from you, or was she way ahead of you, Jay?
I think that there was some nervousness, you know, when you're deciding to jump into something that maybe feels just right. It can be pretty scary, but not just for me, but I feel like from all of our friends, our closest friends, it just felt like the thing that we all knew made sense. And so there was a lot of encouragement, I feel like, from all of us. Yes, do it. This is it.
Now, Jay, is your day job something that you love right now?
No.
Very much not.
Very much not. There were aspects of it that I loved for a while. I'm a union electrician. And
congratulations. A lot of people would love to be a union electrician.
Absolutely. You know, I feel very aware and grateful for that traditional middle-class job that just seems to be disappearing. So I appreciate it, but still the mystery of it is worn off. I've been doing it for quite some time now.
Now, as an electrician, are you on some level supporting Betsy in doing what it is that she loves?
Yeah. You know, she started from scratch. We didn't have really anything, and she just kind of took that risk and has built a beautiful thing from almost nothing. But that job has allowed us to do that for sure. Yeah.
And her joy has spilled over into making your life a little bit less miserable as an electrician.
Absolutely. I mean, how can you not feel enamored with people following their dreams?
What do you think is the pathway for you to get from what it is you're doing now to doing what you love?
Well, Betsy's business being successful is a big part of that. It allows me to have some relief from the financial obligations. And it's just about finding a balance of pursuing my passions and keeping food on the table. And that does feel like the tricky part. It's not an easy thing to do. We're living in a really particular time where I feel like it's become increasingly hard to do that.
And what are your other responsibilities? Just give us a sense of your family, your home life.
Well, we have a 2-year-old.
There you go.
Yeah. So I feel like that's the biggest thing, just keeping our bills paid and making sure she's getting everything she needs.
Do you ever feel as though if you do have a 2-year-old you're responsible for, and as a couple, that sometimes it might be a little selfish to pursue your dreams when really what you need is to create stability for a little person in the world?
I think ultimately I'd like to provide a role model of something that she would want to do and allow her to pursue her dreams too, or her interests in the world.
Well, the 2-year-olds often have an interest in frosting.
Yes.
<It's> Luckily, ours doesn't have too much of an interest in that yet.
Yeah, well, that'll come.
But
yeah.
I think, too, that there's, you know, I say this with caution because I feel like it is hard enough for people to put food on the table
right. Nowadays.
Mm-hmm. So I feel like we're fortunate in that we're able to do that right now. And I also feel like I want to be able to leave her some kind of legacy she can be proud of, too. And I think that you're right. People do that in a number of ways. You know, we have family members who are avid fishermen. You know, you bring up fishing, and for them, that is something that is profound to them. It's not only a physical thing, but it's a spiritual thing, and I think that they do a lot of teaching their families about life through that experience, even though it doesn't relate at all to their jobs. So there are lots of ways to contribute these things, and I think that we're also trying to do that through our work, if we're able to. It has yet to be seen, but we're going to try.
As a couple, any advice out there to people who are trying to help their partner make the leap, trying to have patience to sit in the job that they don't love while the other person sort of gets up and running? Any advice to couples who might be going or contemplating the experience that you've already embarked upon?
I mean, personally, I feel like for me, it's patience and trying to see the bigger picture and being kind to each other. You know, that's something that I feel profoundly grateful to Betsy for. I've gone out of my way to do what I can so that she can do what she needs to do. But you know what? She's shown me a lot of kindness and a lot of appreciation through that whole process. And it builds our relationship. It makes us stronger together. Maybe I've given something, but we're both giving so much all the time. If you're able to do that for each other, then I feel like you're on the right track.
And business is fine. Nine cakes is fine.
Yes, it's going well. Yeah. Yep.
No, no prospect of 10 cakes or 11 cakes.
I don't think so. No. I think we're good at nine.
We're going to stand at nine.
Yeah.
All right. Betsy Thorleifson and Jay Bourne, thanks so much.
Thanks,
Thank
John.
You.
Jay Bourne is an electrician making a transition to his first love, radio. His wife, Betsy Thorleifson, owns her own bakery, Nine Cakes, in Brooklyn. There's a takeaway, actually. For everyone pursuing their dreams, there's a loyal, patient partner waiting, supporting in the wings. It's a team sport pursuing your dreams. You've got the practical pusher of the bobsled bringing up the rear and the person in the front with the best view of the wild ride down the mountain, steering. What do you think? Which are you? Practical? Passionate? Are you doing what you love or helping someone you love reach their dreams? Dream a little for us. In advance of the State of the Union address coming up tomorrow, we're asking for your help in putting together a State of the Union to-do list for President Obama. We're calling it SOTU To-Do. What should the priorities for Barack Obama be? What are the words that boil it down? Income inequality, climate change. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. Use the hashtag SOTU To-Do. That's hashtag SOTUTODO. We'll make our own listener-sponsored to-do list for the president. From Seattle, Washington, fire Arnie Duncan. Give schools power to educate kids without federal standardizing mandates.
Hi, this is Susan from St. Paul, and I think that Obama should have on the top of his to-do list to increase science funding like he said he would do 2 years ago at his State of the Union. He could get the funds to do so by taxing the top 1% at the rate that he taxes the rest of us.
Republican or Democrat, give us your to-do list for President Obama at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.